Welcome to Brainstorm, Decoding Depression, where we will dig into discussions about mood disorders. We're here to change the way we think and talk about depression in an accessible, approachable way with a leading expert in the field. No topic is off limits. Coming to you from Dallas, Texas, this is Brainstorm.
The opinions expressed are our own and do not reflect those of UT Southwestern, the O'Donnell Brain Institute in the UT system, or the state. Welcome to another episode of Brainstorm, Decoding Depression. I'm your guide, Harmony Hilton, and joining me here today is Dr. Madhukar Trivedi, the director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care at UT Southwestern, and Ms. Terry Bentley Hill, a practicing attorney and mental health advocate. Welcome, Ms. Bentley Hill. We are looking forward to this conversation. So please, please tell us more about yourself and your background.
Well, hello, Harmony and Dr. Trivedi. Thank you for having me. I've been listening and admiring your good work, and I'm glad to be here. And of course, I love doing anything with Dr. Trivedi. So I'm very glad to be here. Obviously, as you mentioned, I am a criminal defense attorney, practicing attorney, but I am more than that. I am a mental health advocate, and shout from the depths of the sea to the top of the mountains that we need to discuss mental health issues, we need to understand them, and we need to change the way we look at mental health issues, especially with teenagers, younger kids. And I say that because I have personal experiences with mental health issues, not only my own. I'm in depression remission, but also with my family members. And I have lost two members in my family, immediate family, my former husband and my 14-year-old daughter to suicide. And so because of that incredible pain that I experienced, I just thought there has to be purpose for this. And the purpose that it, for me, is every day trying to educate people about mental health issues, suicide awareness and prevention. I've started a foundation initiative called Stop Minding Your Own Business because of some of the things I've learned in the last 30 years as a result of the losses that I've experienced.
Well, something we always ask, but I feel like you've really answered this. So we're talking about here today, celebrating women who tell our mental health stories. And the focus today is on women in law, as well as the research to improve mental health. So even though you've gone over it, we'd love to hear from you both. As a listener, why should I care about this topic? And what is in it for me as a listener?
Well, it's important for every one of us to understand and experience the resources and the understanding that can shine the light on a subject matter that often lives in the shadow of shame. And I say that because I was that person who, number one, I often say, and Dr. Trivedi can, I'm sure, expound on this, but I often say you don't know you have a mental health issue until you don't. And what I mean by that is that I knew something wasn't right. Things were wrong. I mean, I isolated and I didn't want to talk to people. I could cry at the drop of a hat. I did that a lot through my life. And as a matter of fact, I have learned that I also had an anxiety issue when I was a little kid, started biting my nails when I was 5 years old. But see, I didn't know any of that until someone else in my family had a crisis. And I had to then get busy and get into therapy and figure out how do I survive this incredible loss. And in the meantime, then all of the discovery about my own mental health issues, the depression, the anxiety. And oftentimes when people lose loved ones to suicide, they'll experience their own depression. Well, that's what happened to me. I mean, when my former husband died, you know, it's like my life imploded. And so I learned all of this about myself as well and started treating my own depression. I tried to treat it. Someone had said to me, depression is situational. And once you get past that situation, then the depression lifts. So I believed them. And for 5 years, I was absolutely miserable after my husband died until my therapist said, you don't have to live like this. You can take some medication because your brain can't make the chemicals for you to feel better, but you don't have to live like this. And she was right. So once I went on medication, it made all the difference in the world. But it was like a three-legged stool, though. I needed the medication, I needed the therapy, and I also needed peer support. So it was all of that. And I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, one of the things I've learned is that there is a language of depression. And I didn't speak the language of depression, but I know that my former husband spoke the language of depression, both verbally and nonverbally. And so did my young daughter, who, you know, I'm not being mean to myself. I just didn't know. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what they were saying. So I have learned the language of depression.
So first and foremost, thank you so very much, Terry, for joining. I have admired what you do. It is not the easiest thing, and your losses are obviously profound. And I still see you out in the community really being an amazing advocate. You raise a few things that I just want to quickly highlight. One is, and Harmony mentioned it, we're talking actually to women this year. Women have double the rate of depression than men do. The rate of depression in boys and girls is the same, but it immediately shoots up to double the rate in girls as soon as they hit puberty and stays high all their lives. And there are some very stark problems. Women in Texas have the highest mortality rate for perinatal period compared to any other place in the country. And two of the most common causes associated with that mortality and maternal mortality is depression and partner violence, which is obviously related. And then we are not really the language part, that vocabulary part. And the vocabulary issue is not only for the patients themselves, but their families, and more importantly, for the health system and for the payers and for legislatures, et cetera. Because if there is no vocabulary, there is not going to be support from administration. So I think that what you highlight is absolutely essential, and I am so very thankful you're joining us today. I think the only final point I'll make, and then let Harmony take over, and that is that original anxiety issue that you raised is something we have ignored as a field. There is a large predisposition that people have to depression when they, as kids or young adults, have had anxiety. And we don't treat anxiety very aggressively in our country. And so there are other things and other lessons to be learned from your story. But more importantly, and most importantly in my view, is we as researchers will continue to do what we do, but we will only bend the curve if people like you and the community really both get engaged and demand more from the field. And so again, thank you.
Well, Ms. Bentley Hill, you are a nationally recognized mental health advocate and criminal defense attorney. And to set the foundation for our audience, we want to mention that you have many local and national awards and accolades, such as being Super Laura by Thomas Reuters and the recipient of the Texas Bar Foundation's Terry Lee Grantham Memorial Award for Excellence in the Legal Profession. You've been recognized by your own peers as one of the Dallas's best criminal defense lawyers in the area of mental health representation. You are a distinguished mental health advocate with authentic, powerful lived experience. So to set the foundation and landscape, please share a little bit more about your lived experience, that space where women, law, and youth mental health intersect, and why that's specifically important to you.
Well, I became involved with the Texas Lawyers Assistance Program as soon as I passed the bar And I didn't go to law school. By the way, ladies, it is never too late to do whatever you want to do and reach your goals and your dreams, because I didn't go to law school until I was 46 years old. I graduated when I was 50 years old and started and went into private practice. But as soon and the reason why I wanted to be a lawyer is because I was a news reporter and I covered the police department and the courthouse. And I'd go and I'd cover these trials. And I would have this endorphin release. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the most exciting thing that I've ever seen. Well, that's why crime shows are so popular, because there's that interest that people have in the criminal justice system. But when I was covering those trials, I thought, that's what I want to do. So one of these days, I want to go to law school and become a lawyer and practice criminal law. And I always thought I'd be a prosecutor because I marry prosecutors. My first husband was a prosecutor. My second husband, my current husband, is a prosecutor. But because I was 50 and I wanted my flexibility and wanted to do what I wanted to do, I thought I don't want to work in someone's office. So I'm just going to open my own shop, and started practicing criminal defense. And it's a perfect fit. It's funny how that works, because I really, really like what I do and represent people who oftentimes, for the very first time in their life, they have maybe a mental health crisis or like Dr. Trivedi said, a substance use issue where they get in trouble with the law, and they go through the criminal justice system. And if they have a felony, and if they go on probation, or if they're convicted of that felony, it can change their life forever. They can't rent an apartment. They can't oftentimes find a job. It is life changing. And I've seen some very wonderful people who have a medical condition that can be treated, that bump up against the law, and they go to jail and they sit in jail. And I don't believe sick people belong in jail, because I've seen it, and I can vouch for the fact that if you treat the underlying condition, which may be the mental health condition, and they're properly treated, and they have encouragement to do that through the criminal justice system for a period of time, where it becomes more habitual, where they'll take their medication or they'll go to therapy or whatever, they don't get back into the criminal justice system. And then we can have their cases expunged, and they can go on with their lives without it being a black mark on their lives forever. But the reason I became very involved with the Texas Lawyers Assistance Program is because my former husband, like I said, was an attorney, and he was an elected official, and he suffered with a substance use disorder, alcoholism. And what I didn't know, what we don't know, we don't know. And I didn't know that what the situation was. I didn't know he had a progressive illness. I just thought he was a big jerk and wouldn't stop drinking and didn't love me enough, or didn't love his kids enough to stop drinking. I didn't know what I was dealing with. But because he was a public official, we didn't ask for help, because he thought it would ruin his career. So we lived in the shadows of shame. And once I saw the toll that his job took on him, the pressures of the profession, once I became a lawyer, I thought, by golly, I'm going to do whatever I can do to help other attorneys who may be struggling. And there are a lot of us. The statistics are out there. The profession suffers from depression more than any other profession. It is very difficult being an attorney. And we really think there are a lot of reasons for that. But one of them is because it's an adversarial nature of the profession, where we're all battling one another, trying to figure out, you know, is my case better than your case? And I've got to win it is very high stress. And so I thought, if I can help another attorney prevent the disaster that happened in my life with my former husband, and that's why I decided to throw myself into the wellness program with the Lawyers Assistance program. And it's very nice to be recognized by your peers, don't get me wrong, but I think that the most important thing is that if one person can be helped, that's all that matters.
As you know, we passed September as Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. But NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, has some quick facts that suicide not only has individual impact, but it has a community one as well. So the CDRC, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, specifically AFSP, study examines the relationship between inflammation and suicidal thoughts and actions. Can you please share some more about that connection between all of these things, Dr. Trivedi?
So I think Terry's explanation and description of what she has gone through is clearly at the heart of what we are trying to really change. Because suicide, unfortunately, is not exactly totally predictable. So what happens is people are at risk for suicide, but you don't know if that'll be Monday or next year or 2 years from now. And so our real interest is to find out if we can understand the biology and the cognitions and other factors associated with the risk so that we can then actually begin to start intervening early enough so that that Monday or that next year does not come. And in order to do that, we are looking at the brain function, body functions. There are, for example, if there is inflammation in the body, that does affect how the brain circuits associated with reward and pleasure and success and happiness revolve. So if we can identify that in advance, then we can treat that so that then somebody who is at risk doesn't actually ever execute their plan. And so looking at it at the early stages, like we do with all medical illnesses, I think one of the things people forget is for all the advances in medicine, most of the places, even in cancer, where we have made the biggest impact is either prevention or early recognition, not late coming in and doing the best treatment, because there we often fail. And I think our goal is to do that for suicide.
Oh, that is so hopeful to hear that, because if you will, you allow me, when I talked about the language of depression, I'd like to give a few examples, because especially with parents, they'll say, well, and Dr. Trivedi, you certainly can answer this and address this, but parents will come to me and they'll say, I don't know if my teenager is just acting like a normal teenager, or is there something I should be concerned about? Which is, I've been there. I understand that. I have four daughters, and I didn't know either. I just thought this moodiness, this oversleeping, this, you know, listening to morose, music. It's just, I just thought, well, maybe that's just what teenagers do. So I think the language of depression, and Dr. Trivedi, I have a question too about this when you talk about that inflammation and whether or not, you know, will the suicide happen on Monday or what could it happen a month later or whatever. I think that's so interesting because my former husband, for example, he tried very serious capital murder cases. And one of the cases happened to be the murder of a police officer on Christmas night. And the shooter was a 17-year-old boy. And back then, this was in the early 80s, back then you could get the death penalty on a 17-year-old. You cannot get the death penalty any longer, but he was seeking the death penalty. My husband took this case very, very seriously because, of course, it affected a police officer. He worked with police officers every day. He became friends with the widow. And so he asked for the death penalty, but that when that young man took the stand, he looked like he was 14 years old, and that jury comes back with life in prison instead of the death penalty. And my husband said to me, he said, you know, Terry, I have let everybody down. I have let the police officer down. I have let his widow down. I have let the community down. I have let myself down. I might as well kill myself. And I remember when he said that, I thought, well, that's extreme. It just shocked me because my brain, despite the fact that I've experienced depression and I know what depression is, my brain has never gone to that place. And even my daughter, when we were treating her, we knew she was experiencing depression, but she would say things like, I have no friends. Nobody likes me. Nobody will sit with me at the cafeteria. And in fact, I went and volunteered at the cafeteria just to see if she was sitting by herself. And of course she wasn't. But it didn't matter what I thought. What I thought was irrelevant. It's what she thought.
And I think that is exactly why we have to develop a kind of, like we do with other medical illnesses, develop tests that can be done. So when your husband is in that place where he is thinking he is let people down, when you know, and he knows actually cognitively that he didn't, he got a full criminal verdict. And yet that change in how that stress affects the brain, how the thinking pattern happens, if we can begin to develop tests for that, then we can actually do something. And that is really the idea behind this, because I think we have first to develop the language and the vocabulary. Second, we have to stop describing teenagers as teens being teens. I think if there is something different, we need to intervene. We don't allow, if you go to a family and there is a couple, husband and wife, the husband never says, let her, my wife be the, my wife. They interact. They decide that this is not normal. Same thing we need to do for teenagers. But I think we have to be proactive is what you're saying. And I totally agree.
And normalize it, right?
Absolutely.
And right now, it's just that people are, I think, and you correct me, I don't know if I'm right about this, but this is just what I've thought, is that people don't want to deal with it because they don't understand it.
Absolutely.
And they're afraid of it.
40 years back, if a 45-year-old male put a hand on his chest, people would say, it sounds like indigestion, let's do something. Now, if a 45-year-old sits somewhere in a restaurant and puts his hand on his chest and grimaces, people will run to give him a defibrillator because we have developed the language, we don't take it lightly, and we normalize the fact that this is a high risk for heart disease. I think we have to start doing the same for mental health.
So something I think we're all touching on but hasn't been explicitly stated is stigma. Can both of you talk some more about stigma of mental health in the news, out there in the community, when parents talk about it? Please share a little bit more about that.
My thought about stigma is we have to create knowledge. We have to transmit that knowledge to the community, and we have to get community engaged. There is no one anti-stigma thing available. Susan Komen, when she started this whole idea about breast cancer, wasn't by saying, let's remove the stigma of breast cancer. There was real knowledge being created. There was real engagement for the community. There was real... What we have to do is create a situation both through knowledge, research, studies, as well as community engagement, where we as a society say, nobody's going to have to suffer through this on my watch.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I just think there is such a fear factor that if I raise my hand and say, I have a mental health issue that I need to address, that then people will look at me differently. And that I may lose my job, and that people will then think that I'm a loose cannon, or I can't handle the stress, or whatever. It's just that. So I think people live with that, and our secrets keep us sick. And I just really think it's because of the stigma. And I know for a lot of attorneys, they won't get help because they're afraid it will cost them. Yeah, it will cost them their job, or their clients will fire them, whatever the case may be. And it's when that happens for those attorneys or people in general who are afraid to say I need help, and they don't get the help, and or if they do get the help and then there's backlash, then oftentimes they will take their life. I mean, it is a vicious kind of rock and a hard place. And so that's why I agree with Dr. Trivedi. It's just normalizing this and making mental health the focus of that as safe and as normal as physical health.
Yes. Well, thank you both for the work you do for making mental health a priority and for sharing so much insight and knowledge. It's so needed. We really appreciate it. So we want to give you a chance with any closing thoughts, you know, or share where our listeners can find out and reach out and learn more. So if you're going to leave our listeners not only with some knowledge, but with a call to action, we want to give you that space to share.
Well, thank you, Harmony. Oftentimes, a person who is struggling, they don't know what they're struggling with. They will be showing signs that indicate that they may be experiencing incredible anxiety or depression. I mean, you know, young girls pulling their hair out of their parts, whatever the case may be. They may not really be able to grasp what is going on with them themselves, but we can see it. And we have to stop minding our own business. I encourage people to step out of your comfort zone and ask the question, are you okay? Can I talk to you? I'm concerned about you. I love you. What can I do? Can I help you? Can we just talk? And then let them talk. Let them verbalize it. Because I think that once a person is able to verbalize and be validated for the way they're feeling, I feel like it relieves some of that pressure, that crisis. And so my message is to stop minding your own business and step out of your comfort zone and reach out to people who are struggling.
My only message is listen to Terry Hill. And if she is talking somewhere, go attend. Make it a point to attend, because I think that the way you articulately describe this issue, for example, stop minding your own business. People who have the problem don't know. Therefore, we have to set in place routine ways to observe, intervene. I think you covered it. So thank you again so much for joining us.
My pleasure. And I'm easy to find. I'm terrybentleyhill.com. terrybentleyhill.com. You'll find my website and you can get hold of me.
Thank you both. And that's it for this episode of Brainstorm, Decoding Depression, with your host from the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care. Be sure to follow us on social media at UT Southwestern _CDRC so you don't miss our episode announcements. If you have any suggestions for topics or questions you'd like answered, please send us an email at decodingdepressionpodcast@utsouthwestern.edu. Thank you for listening.